loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the European Union and the United States have pulled back from the brink of an intensified trade war, with President Trump and EU Commission head Juncker coming to an accord yesterday. Next, it appears unlikely that the federal government will meet its court-mandated order to reunite migrant families who were separated at the border under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy. Of the 2,551 children separated from their parents, only 1,187 have been returned. Then Imran Khan and his PTI party appear to have won the Pakistani election, promising an end to corruption, foreign dependency, and joblessness. What does his election mean for the country and for the region? And then a flotilla of boats carrying peace activists protesting Israel's occupation and bombing of Gaza has left Palermo, Italy, its final stop in Europe, to begin the voyage to Gaza. And finally, mainstream capitalist economic theory has increasingly been called into question since the global economic crisis of 2008 exposed the gaping holes in neoliberal orthodoxy. One new school of thought that's emerged in recent years is modern monetary theory. Today, we'll take a closer look at what that theory is. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the issue of tariffs. The European Union and the United States have pulled back from the brink of an intensified trade war, with President Trump and EU Commission head Juncker coming to an accord yesterday. We're joined from New York by Richard Wolff. He's a professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and founder of the organization Democracy at Work. Professor Wolff's latest book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good to be here.
We're glad to have you both. Professor Wolff, let's start with you. There was a lot that was made today at the White House in an unscheduled press conference between President Trump and Commissioner Juncker. And President Trump announced, kind of oddly, really, that the two had agreed to work toward eliminating tariffs, all barriers on trade, and reducing tensions for what really looked to be a brewing trade war. It's essentially a deal to make a deal. What should we expect to come out of this?
Mostly nothing. This was an exercise for the media and for the political supporters of these two gentlemen. This was a face-saving operation. Let me explain. Number one, European and American negotiators have, at least for the last 40 years, periodically gotten together and committed themselves to eliminating tariffs and other manipulations of trading relationships between them. It has meant nothing in the past, and there is no reason to believe it means any more today than it has all the other times that's done, number one. Number two, Mr. Trump said that the Europeans promised to buy massive amounts of soybeans. They're not going to do that for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is they don't use soybeans the way the Chinese did. And the problem for American farmers is that Mr. Trump's tariffs have been retaliated by the Chinese, so they're not going to buy the soybeans. And they buy way more than the Europeans ever did. And therefore, this whole thing is a fakery, but it is a nice way to say to the soybean farmers who have been yelling bloody murder at Mr. Trump because of what he's doing, having voted for him, this is a way for him to look like he's at least for the time being taking their concerns seriously and doing at least something. But it is, again, 90% show, 10% anything real, and it will not solve the problem of the soybean farmers of America, and within a short matter of weeks and months, they will see that. Finally, Mr. Trump promised that the Europeans will buy massive amounts of liquefied natural gas. This was an attempt to show his supporters and his critics how he's being nasty to the Russians, since the Russians are the major providers of liquefied and other forms of natural gas to Europe. However, the Europeans have long-term contracts with the Russians. The Russian natural gas is cheaper and closer than is the American. And so there again, the overwhelming likelihood is that we will look back on these statements by Mr. Trump with the same bemused amazement at how he can say one thing and do another, that we greet most of what the man says in the last 2 years. A last point. Mr. Juncker did actually get something. How real it is, we'll see. He got the commitment of the president not to impose tariffs on automobiles coming to the United States from Europe. That is something that the Europeans are very concerned about, particularly the Germans, who are the major players in this regard. And so they actually got a commitment, how firm we'll see, but they actually got something that matters a lot to them, whereas the rest of it is, to be kind and polite, mostly verbiage, but nothing much beyond that.
Walter, I was struck today at the tone of the press. First of all, I think Professor Wolf is exactly right, because this is not a simple issue. It's a very complicated issue, and you can't just stand in the Rose Garden and say, we have a deal, when there is no deal. And even if you did have a deal, what would the deal be about? As the professor says, we need to talk about everything. We need to talk about automobiles and blueberries and soybeans and textiles and a whole wide variety of things. So knowing Donald Trump, as well as any of us know Donald Trump, what do you think happens next?
Well, I think that the trade war with China is certainly going to go forward. I mean, in a way, if there was any sort of strategic sense to this, then I think it's so that the United States can wage a more effective economic conflict with China, which is still very much on and could, in fact, intensify in the coming weeks and months. I believe was primarily tactical, you know, the decision to hold this sort of impromptu press conference with Jean-Claude Juncker because of, going back to the point that Professor Wolf was making, that, you know, because the Trump administration came under from such intense fire from, you know, all sectors of the political and media establishment for the Helsinki summit with President Putin of Russia, that he sort of had to retreat some way or show in some manner that he's actually going after Russia very intensely, which I think is actually in his policy for the entirety of his administration, all the sanctions, all the diplomatic expulsions. You know, going back to what he said at the NATO summit to Angela Merkel, you know, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is this new pipeline construction that would transport gas from Russia through the Baltic and into Germany. You know, Donald Trump was very critical of that, openly critical of that during the NATO summit and, you know, in other venues as well. And so this new deal to export large amounts, you know, whatever that means, of liquefied natural gas from the United States to the European Union, which, you know, also, as Professor Wolf pointed out, doesn't make too much economic sense because, you know, the gas in Russia is right there, like Russia borders the European Union or it borders, you know, the EU periphery. So I think that what comes next could be more of the same in terms of the big picture strategy, but could lead to, at least for the short term, a hardening of relations with Russia.
Dr. Wolf, we have about 2 minutes left. I wanted to ask you about something that the British and German press has been saying this afternoon or have been saying this afternoon, and that is that the ultimate goal here, which is eminently reachable, is zero tariffs and zero barriers, just as Donald Trump said it was. Do you believe that? And if you do you think it's possible?
It's highly unlikely. It is something that, as I say, they have said to each other in countless forums, privately, publicly, diplomatically, and they've never done it. I should stress for everyone listening to this that the ways of manipulating trade are many. Tariffs is only one way. I'll give you an example. The French immediately announced yesterday that they are not about to allow any imports of American agricultural goods, such as soybeans, because they have rules about GMO altered crops. They have rules about protecting their own agriculture. They have rules about health and safety that American products do not fulfill, do not meet. And they're not going to give all that up. And that operates as a barrier to trade, if you like. It's defended on grounds of health and well-being. But if you start looking at all the things a government does, which, by the way, includes interest rates and monetary policy, almost everything affects trade. So if you're really going to get rid of barriers to trade, if tariffs and other things are actually what you're talking about countries interfering in one another's basic organization of what they do, and they have been very loath to let anything like that happen. And again, the Europeans, looking at Mr. Trump, above all, the idea that he would have some kind of ongoing say about what they do and don't do.
Yeah, good luck. We're going to have to leave it there, Professor. That was the voice of Professor Richard Wolff. He's Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he's currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program in International Affairs at the New School in New York City. And we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It appears unlikely that the federal government will meet its court-mandated order to reunite migrant families who were separated at the border under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy. Of the 2,551 children separated from their parents, only 1,187 have been returned. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona, by Isabel Garcia. She's the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's half the kit. That's less than half.
Yeah, less than half have been reunited. This is a disaster. So what happens next, Isabel? The government is either unwilling or unable to do what the federal courts have ordered it to do. So now what?
Yeah, I think it's a real disaster that is of their own making. That's really the worst part of it. The worst part is that they went ahead and implemented a program, you know, destroying families, separating families. They knew what they were doing, separating them, without really any kind of humanity to say, look, we're separating children from parents, so we've got to make sure that this child that we're going to, you know, send across the country is going to eventually be able to be reunited with their parent. To have no decency to have done that is just mind-boggling. You know, they've deported, 460-some parents without their children, some of them under 5 years old. Can you just begin to imagine that and how quick children can be impacted at these ages, even beyond five? I mean, 6, 7-year-olds. Can you imagine this? It's a disaster, and this government has to do something. I think it's appalling. It's shameful. What can I tell you? It's up to them to put every effort to find these parents and match them with their children, whether they've been convicted of the illegal entry or not, whether they've got a DUI in their past. It doesn't at all justify what they've done here at the border, what we've done, because really it was all done in our name, with our taxpayer money, and so we all have to take responsibility.
Isabel, ICE told the judge yesterday, according to Newsweek magazine, that there are more than 900 children who either have been deemed ineligible for reunification or are not yet known to be eligible. What in the world does that mean?
Well, can you imagine what that means to be ineligible? It means what? That one of their parents has a conviction, is what I read, that they may be suspected, you know, of having some kind of crime, so that they've got a follow-up and you're ineligible? Who says you're ineligible? Right? I guess if they're going to hold them for reentry charges, let's say that you have a formal deportation and they're holding you for the felony. That means that they're going to permanently separate that child, because I think that's one of the cases of ineligibility, because they're going to be processed in the federal court for the felony crime of illegal reentry. You know, 1326 in the federal code. So ineligible because what, the parents don't submit to a DNA test. Ineligible. Why? Why are they ineligible? We need to find out if they were ineligible to be reunited, they should have been ineligible to be separated.
That's really an important point. But it's only because of the court order that the government is now scrambling and is compelled to scramble or compelled to appear to scramble to put these kids back with their folks. Because originally, Jeff Sessions didn't care.
No, at all.
Trump didn't care.
Remember, Azar said, oh, yeah, we can locate every child in one phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What happened to that?
That was never true.
They were, what they wanted to do, this is really important. These families came seeking asylum. You know, there's a process. There's a legal process. All countries have a process. There are international treaties for asylum. So you're seeking asylum because you're fleeing violence, you're fleeing repression, whatever.
But you're eligible to do, and it's a lawful process.
So it's a lawful process. So then what happened is that the Trump administration basically, in essence, de facto, shut down the port of entry in the different places. So families were lingering. And then many of them said, okay, we're not going to get through the bridge where there's a port of entry, a legal place. So we'll go a half a mile and then we'll go around and we'll come in and then they'll go to an ICE official and say, here we are, we're here for asylum. And then the ICE official said, ah, you came in illegally after they blocked them really from coming through legally. And now that becomes the basis for them to be separated from their kids.
Correct. When they are permitted, to request asylum in the circumstances that you just delineated there. That is proper. If they cross through the imaginary line, because many places, you know, you don't even know you're crossing where you are crossing, at any instance, you are authorized to have at least a credible fear interview to see if, in fact, you can begin the process. And it was clear that there was a directive to ignore all of that, and treat them all the same and punish them basically for having come.
You know, we have all kinds of instances, John. It's talked about widely in the media where human beings and sometimes children are used as human shields by an enemy. Let's say you're going to bomb this area. Well, we have a lot of children and their mothers here, so you have to take responsibility when you bomb us, the soldiers or the combatants. You have to, you know, you have to take responsibility for bombing these innocent civilians, including kids. Okay, everybody condemns the use of human shields in warfare. What we have right now is a variant of that, because what Jeff Sessions did deliberately is he wanted to have high publicized separations of children from their parents to act as a disincentive,
yep,
a deterrent from other families seeking asylum, even though it's a legal right, as Isabel says, to make you have the right to try to assert your credible asylum claim. If you're going to lose your kids and you see it's happening to everybody, well, you won't come and seek asylum. That's what it is. They're using the kids really as
the human shield.
As
you're
a
right.
human shield, really.
The human sword, almost.
Yeah. Isabel, There's a piece in the New York Times today that quotes an activist, an immigrant rights activist, and she says that the judge's order, this is a federal judge, the judge's order allows for the arrest and prosecution of ICE officials if they do not reunite these families. Is that true? And is there any scenario at all where you could see something like that happening?
Well, the court would have to find them in contempt of the court order and then begin that kind of proceeding. I don't see them being jailed at this point, but I hope that the courts take a very strong position. Imagine that. Your child being separated, that's as extreme as I can imagine. So, yes, if it requires that some of these officials who are violating these orders or ignoring the orders, if that kind of measure needs to take place, I would agree with it. I think that this is really extreme what they've done. And so our patience is wearing. The patience of these children is wearing. I mean, this is what they call an ACE factor, you know, adverse childhood experience. I mean, it's the number one that they have identified as causing trauma to children, and we are purposely doing this.
You know, Brian, there was a piece in today's Washington Post that said for the first time in recorded history here in the United States, a one-year-old entered a courtroom without an attorney, and the one-year-old was expected to defend himself.
Of course, and I'm sure they did a great job. And of course, let's go back. This was also the Obama administration policy back
in the day
where they were, the Justice Department under Eric Holder was also arguing that children in these hearings should not be provided with legal representation.
That's right. It's a disgrace.
I mean, Trump is making it worse, but it didn't just start with Trump.
That's absolutely right.
Unfortunately, these, you know, Democrats that implemented these horrific structures and then, of course, voila, wound up in the hands of this really deranged person that nobody is checking on his party. It seems like his party has just become the party of Trump.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia. She's the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Imran Khan and his PTI party appear to have won the Pakistani election, promising an end to corruption, foreign dependency, and joblessness. What does this election mean for the country and for the region? We're joined from Pakistan by Tamer Rahman, the General Secretary of the Pakistan Mazdoor Kisan Party, or the Workers' Farmers Party, and from Washington, D.C. by Medea Benjamin, an anti-war and anti-torture activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tamer Rahman, you are the General Secretary of the Mazdoor Kisan Party, and you gave an interview to a Pakistani paper, and you said this. You said, quote, leftist and progressive forces are opposed to Imran Khan because he represents a right-wing shift in Pakistan's politics. Can you explain what you mean there? Were you specifically referencing Imran Khan's ties to the military?
I was. And you see, what's happened in Pakistan over the last year or so has been that there was a conflict between the civilian administration, the elected government, and the military establishment, which came out and was called the Dawn League, and caused a lot of friction between the PMLN, which was in power, and the military. And since then, the military or the establishment, state, etc., has been pushing the screws on the PMLN and promoting this narrative in the mainstream media that these people are corrupt, whereas the actual issue was how Pakistan was dealing with religious extremism. The civilian government was of the view that, the elected government was of the view that the military establishment had a double policy, and that this double policy was pushing Pakistan into international isolation, ruining the economy, and so on. This is the conflict that Imran Khan played upon to come to power, really. He allied himself with the military establishment, allied himself with the religious right. They have been the strongest allies for a long time. And in the run-up to the election, he included in his party under the title of electable some of the big feudal lords and the big capitalists of Pakistan. And so he was able to cobble together a coalition of, you know, of support from the military, of support from the religious right, and of support from the ruling class of Pakistan. And so we don't see this as a progressive change in Pakistan, but rather as a shift towards the right.
Medea, let's get your take. And also, you've been in Pakistan because of your work in Code Pink and your work against the U.S. drone program and the torture program. I mean, you've been there, you've been in the region, and you also know of the, you know, the vast human consequences of these policies. Anyway, talk about your take on the election and also the big picture in terms of what you've been doing there.
Well, first let me say how much I respect your guest, and I don't live in Pakistan, and I certainly don't know the intricacies of Imran Khan's campaign as someone who lives there does. But I know from the outside and having spent some time with him that he did oppose the U.S. drone policy. We went with him to Waziristan, where the victims of the U.S. campaign have been attacked, and he has called for talks with the Taliban. People accuse him of being too close to the Taliban, but let's face it, there need to be talks with the Taliban. The Trump administration is talking to the Taliban now. So I see it as an outsider, as you have these very corrupt political parties that have been entrenched in power for so long, between the Pakistani Muslim League of Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto's party, the People's Party of Pakistan, that Imran Khan is coming in from outside of those legacy families, that he has been focusing on corruption, on poverty. He has shown himself not only as somebody who was adored because he was such a great cricketer, but also because he did things like speak out in favor of the poor. We went to visit the cancer hospital that he built that has been treating cancer patients for free. What he has done in the last years is really shown himself as an advocate for the poor, and that he wants to stop the wars, whether it's the war with the Taliban or whether it's the war with India. And I think we ought to give him a chance.
Okay, Tamer, why don't you jump in if you could?
You see, the imperatives of the anti-war progressive movement of the left in the United States of America and in Pakistan are very, very different. I mean, the imperatives of the part on that side of the world is to stop the war on terror and so on, and to stop the, you know, the madness that's occurring under the title of the war on terror, the way imperialism, etc. So I respect what Nabiha is saying, but the imperatives of the left in Pakistan are very, very different. Here we actually face a life and death struggle with respect to religious extremism, especially in the north of the country. And so we can't afford, although the entire left is opposed to drone strikes and any sort of American involvement or Western involvement in Pakistan or Afghanistan, at the same time, we have to recognize that in order for us to survive, we have to counter what is essentially a fascist threat. Now, fascists also many times make many, many anti-imperialist sort of sounds, as you know, Mussolini did, and Franco did, and so on and so forth. And that's part of fascism, is to appeal to this kind of radical right-wing nationalism. As far as Imran Khan's personal record is concerned, he's a great sportsman. He's an even better philanthropist. There's no doubt about it. He has a lot of really admirable personal qualities, some not so very admirable, but that's not the point. Madina quite rightly pointed out that the PTP and the PMLN are entrenched political parties. But the political party in Pakistan that is the most entrenched is the military establishment. Let's not forget that that's where the real locus of power in Pakistan is. They're the ones that created the religious fundamentalist lobby. They're the ones that manipulate the politics of Pakistan. And whenever it suits their interests, they'll throw out the PTP government, they'll throw out the PMLN. They deliberately keep civilian institutions in Pakistan extremely weak. In the 1990s, they threw out the elected government, you know, four times, whichever one it was. And then finally in 1999, Musharraf took power and sat in power for a good decade. And so we had to fight very hard against the military establishment, both exposing them for their role and complicity in the creation of religious fundamentalism, as well as the destruction of democracy. And throughout that period, of course, it's been the United States of America that has been the military's number one supporter in Pakistan. So we have to see in the context of Pakistan where Imran Khan is aligning himself in relation, or where he's placed in the matrix of power within Pakistan with relation to the military, with relation to the religious fundamentalists. And at the moment, he is right in the center of both of them. He's allied to both of them. He's part of what we call the Military Mullah Alliance, the MMA. He's part of that access. And that is the access that is actually far more entrenched and more difficult to defeat for a progressive change in Pakistan than, say, the PTP or the PMLN. Those are, entrenched political parties as well, but they're not real power holders in Pakistan. Always been the military and, in close alliance with the religious fundamentalists.
You know, when I was living in Pakistan, I was there in 2002, early 2002, to the middle of 2002, and then I went back at the end of the year. It was a military government. It was the government of President Musharraf. I have air quotes around the word president. And I was really fascinated when I got there in that the military always seems to feel that it has a legitimate duty to overthrow democratically elected governments there. And so many people, as Tamer is saying correctly, so many people on the political right expect the military to intervene whenever it doesn't like something in government that's not democratic, frankly. And I think his point is a good one, that while Imran Khan is good on a lot of these issues, The fact that he has the support of the military so strongly and the support of the right wing and religious parties may be a little bit of a problem. Medea, we've got just a little bit of time left. I want to throw it to you, and I wanted to ask you, what should Americans be looking for here? How is Imran Khan going to be different from other Pakistani leaders, both in the region and in relations with the United States?
I think the big challenge for Imran Khan will be to show that he is not a puppet of the military, but he also has tremendous economic problems to be facing. IMF and the screws that it's putting on the Pakistani economy. And so I think in terms of the United States, it's to be hands off, to wait and see and be supporting the civil movements that your guest represents, more secular liberal forces inside Pakistan, be trying to give them more power so that they can confront Imran Khan and try to push him more to be the leader that he says he's going to be, not a puppet of the military.
That was the voice of Medea Benjamin. She joins us from Washington. Medea is an anti-war and anti-torture activist who is the co-founder of Code Pink. And we were joined from Lahore, Pakistan, by Tamer Rahman, the general secretary of the Pakistan Mazdoor Kisan Party, or the Workers' Farmers Party. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We're going to take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A flotilla of boats carrying peace activists protesting Israel's occupation and bombing of Gaza has left Palermo, its final stop in Europe, to begin the voyage to Gaza. We're joined from Italy by Anne Wright. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became a prominent anti-war activist. She's also one of the participants in the flotilla. Welcome back, Anne.
Thank you very much, John and Brian. It's great to be with you.
And can you give us an update on how things are progressing with the flotilla?
I have been with the flotilla for the last month. I've been on one leg of it, actually, as a participant. And normally I'm on that last leg that goes from either Sicily or Greece or wherever we choose to move on into Gaza. This time I decided I would give my place to somebody else. And so Joe Metters, our fellow who was with the USS Liberty, shot at by the Israelis in 1967, with 34 killed and 174 wounded. He is our U.S. participant on this final leg.
In previous flotillas, the Israelis have intercepted you. In one case, I think it was in 2006, the Israelis actually attacked the ship and there were casualties. What do you expect to happen this time? Will you be able to get to Gaza with medicine, with humanitarian supplies?
Well, it was actually in 2010 when the Israelis attacked the Mavi Marmara and the other five ships in that flotilla, killing nine people, executing nine people on the Mavi Marmara and wounding 50, and another person subsequently died. So 10 people died from the Israeli attack. This year, 2018, we have three ships that are now on the high seas sailing toward Gaza. We hope they will be able to reach Gaza. The first ships to reach Gaza since 2008, when some of the Free Gaza Movement ships actually got into Gaza in 2008. But then starting in 2009, the Israelis have stopped all of the boats that we've sent in that direction, no matter what they are carrying. And as you mentioned, our three ships are carrying supplies, 116 boxes of medical supplies, things that have been specifically requested by the Ministry of Health in Gaza, particularly gauze, sterile gauze, and sutures, because of all of the casualties that have happened every Friday, where over 140 Palestinians in Gaza have been executed by Israeli snipers, and over 16,000 have been wounded. So the medical system in Gaza is on its knees. They need more supplies, and our flotilla is taking 116 boxes. A drop in the bucket on one level, but it's as much as we can carry at this time.
And when you think back about what actually happened to the ship, the ship was the Mavi Marmara. It was the lead vessel. There were six vessels. If you I'm looking at a BBC website right now talking about what actually happened. You can't have been around at that time and not remember it so vividly.
Oh, yes.
The ship, the flotillas, these are human rights and peace activists bringing medical supplies.
Unarmed, in any way.
Unarmed. So the Israeli commandos board the ship on the high seas. They're not in Israeli waters. And this was a Turkish, flagged with a Turkish flag at that time. And they just massacred people. And it seemed to me at the time like, wow, what's Israel's calculation? Well, their calculations was, even though it destroyed for a while the relations with Turkey, they had to somehow signal peaceful people who were trying to defy using methods of international human aid shipments, or sort of a kind of civil disobedience. It's not really civil disobedience. That we're going to just meet you with unbridled violence, because it was such a threat to the Israeli establishment. Not an armed struggle. What was a threat was this peaceful demonstration of solidarity with the people of Gaza. They had to go out of their way to show they would use just maximum, ultimate violence and pressure. And right, it says so much about the nature of the Israeli government itself, doesn't it?
Well, indeed it does. And it showed that they were unafraid of using the same type of violence that they use on Palestinians every single day, whether it's in the West Bank or in Gaza, but going ahead and using it on internationals. And there were over 600 internationals among the six ships of that flotilla from about 40 countries. And Israel didn't care. I mean, they were willing to take the wrath of the international community for their attack on unarmed civilians that were trying to break an illegal Israeli blockade of Gaza. They were willing to take the heat. And of course, their big protector, the big brother, the United States of America, did nothing at all. When one of the nine that was executed on the Marvi Marmara, a young 17-year-old man named Furkan Doğan, a Turkish-American citizen, murdered by the Israeli government, and the United States did nothing about it.
Ann Wright is our guest. And right now, I mean, when you said the numbers, in terms of the number of wounded, what was it? You said 6,000?
16,000. 16,000 people have been wounded or injured during this the days of return, the Great Return March, every Friday. It's a horrific number of people that have been wounded and injured by the Israelis. I mean, it's startling, the statistics that you see, and 150 people that have been executed. The Israeli government says that they know every person that they kill, that they are specifically targeting specific people, and if they don't kill them, they wound them in such a way that they will be maimed for the rest of their lives. The numbers of amputations that have had to take place on people who have been shot through the legs, targeted in the legs. They are totally out of prosthetic devices, out of crutches. The numbers of people that are being targeted for either death or permanent maiming is astounding.
And I read the Israeli press this morning, and there was a lot of coverage, frankly, about the flotilla. But the participants in the flotilla were universally described as terrorist sympathizers. Do you get any kind of favorable reaction from Israelis at all? Is there anybody, or are there any organizations in Israel that can see past the politics of this and see the humanitarian work that you're doing?
Yes, indeed there are. And there are groups that will be protesting at the Israeli foreign ministry. There will be groups that will be out on the streets to say to their countrymen and women who think everybody is a terrorist, that indeed these people that are on the flotilla are not terrorists. And if you look at the bios, which we, of course, publish on our website, the Israelis know very well that these people that are on that flotilla have long histories of social activism in their own countries, that they are peaceful, nonviolent people who have gone through special training, peaceful, nonviolent training specifically for this mission. And the Israelis know it. They know it very, very well. And the Israeli press, the part of the press that is totally controlled by the Israeli government, of course, puts the government spin on it, that everybody on that is a terrorist. And of course, it's blatantly false. It's Israeli propaganda. And they've been doing that for every one of the flotillas, calling everyone that's a part of this a terrorist, when all we are doing is challenging an illegal blockade of 2 million people in Gaza that are living under horrific, horrific conditions, conditions of lack of water, lack of electricity, lack of sewage capability to get sewage off the streets and processed properly, the lack of medical facilities. These are the things that the World Health Organization has said that by the year 2020, which is a year and a half from now, Gaza will become uninhabitable because of the conditions there. And I believe that is exactly what the state of Israel wants. They want to make Gaza so uninhabitable that it will force people to say, I have to leave. I can't live here any longer because we're gonna all die here because of the conditions here.
Yeah, and this operation, John, paid for by the USA, $4 billion a year for economic and military aid to the state of Israel. You know, Israel's imposing the blockade, but all of the resources, or not all, but a great amount of the resources are coming really from the United States,
yes,
from U.S. taxpayers. The U.S. does it, and Israel knows it's going to continue to do it, meaning the U.S. government. It's time for people in the United States to say that the government does this, but not with our consent.
That's right. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from Italy by Anne Wright. She's a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. She's also one of the participants in the flotilla. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Mainstream capitalist economic theory has increasingly been called into question since the global economic crisis of 2008 exposed the gaping holes in neoliberal orthodoxy. One new school of thought that's emerged in recent years is modern monetary theory. Today, we're going to go over the second part of our discussion with Professor Stephanie Kelton. She's a prominent economist. She advised Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign. And we're also joined from Pittsburgh by Jim Kavanaugh, editor of thepolemicist.net. His latest piece on today's topic is Behind the Money Curtain, a Left Take on Taxes, Spending, and Modern Monetary Theory. Jim Kavanaugh, let's begin with you in this, the second segment of our discussion on modern monetary theory. What makes this theory different from earlier progressive, either Keynesian or socialist economic theories? Of course, I would say in general that Marx and Capital, at least in Volume 1 of Capital, made the argument that the value of money or the value of gold, which was used as money, isn't arbitrary, that it was based on both as a universal equivalent for commodities. In other words, all commodities could see themselves and find themselves and express themselves quantifiably through gold or through money, that it was measurable, that it was consistent, and that if there were price changes, that it fluctuated around value, and that value was determined based on the average amount of socially necessary labor in a product. In other words, not an arbitrary price or an arbitrary value. But is part of the modern monetary theory taking exception with that idea that because governments have this capacity to print money, at least in the modern era, that it is fairly and relatively arbitrary, and money thus just becomes nothing more than a policy instrument? Is that in essence where this theory differs?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's necessarily in contradiction with either Marx or Keynesian theory in that sense. I mean, what Marx is talking about the production of value in the Capital Volume 1. I consider myself a Capital Volume 1 Marxist. And value isn't money. In the 19th century, when Marx was talking, money was gold, and it was a universal equivalent commodity. But in a context, what Stephanie and MMT people are saying, and what's the case, is that in a context where there is no universal equivalent commodity, money is not the commodity gold now. Money is the numbers that the government puts in your account, puts in electronic ledgers. What it makes clear is that the decisions about money is a public and social creation. When the government creates money by spending, by putting money into the economy, it's the public authority that's doing that. It's not a private person that's doing that. This puts the focus, I think, where it should be, on the nature of the public authority. Is it democratic? Is it transparent? Who sits down and how and decides how much we're going to spend, because we're going to spend a finite amount, and where we're going to spend it? Only thing that MMT is saying is that the answer to that question does not depend on how much we can collect in taxes, because it doesn't. It just doesn't. And in a modern, in a theory where there's no, in a society where there's not a universal equivalent commodity, it depends on what we want to do. These are political choices. We can sit down and say, okay, we have X amount of money we can spend based on our calculation that that's what the productive capacity of the economy can afford. Do we want to, what's the first thing that we want to spend it on, healthcare or nuclear weapons? That's a political decision. It's not where we're going to get the money to spend on healthcare or nuclear weapons. It's what do we want to do? And so the whole thing focuses our attention on the political decision of where we're going to put the money. Now, in terms of the Marxist thing, it's important to say that money isn't value. And what Marx is saying there, and I think Michael Hudson has been very good about this, is that in a capitalist economy, everything is determined by the value. The expression, primary expression of value, is money. So that's a very important thing. But money is essentially, yes, it should be like a public utility. It's like oil in the economy. You put too much in, it's going to smother it. You put too little in, it's going to seize up. But it is the public authority, and the character of that becomes important, and the decisions that are made about that, that creates and puts money into the economy and decides where to take it from. If we put too much in, we're going to take some out. Where are we going to take it from? There's no constraint about that. And that's why in 1946, the chairman of the Federal Reserve was, well, the purpose of taking money out of the economy is to take money from the rich people. Not let there be too much inequality. That's one of the main purposes. If there's too much in the economy as a whole, then you want to take some out.
That's the voice of Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. We're also joined by Professor Stephanie Kelton, prominent economist who advised Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign. She has many other important sort of credentials here. But Professor Kelton, I want to go back and ask you about whether this modern monetary theory applies to all economies with different currencies, or is it really based and focused on the United States? And the reason I'm asking is that at the end of World War II and after the Bretton Woods Conference and with the creation of the IMF and the World Bank and the UN, the dollar became the world's currency. It became the place where and the instrument through which trade takes place. Now, the U.S. government has this privileged position. It can print dollars, the world currency. But say, take a country like Greece, which cannot. And Greece, which is no longer using the drachma, is no longer using its own national currency, is functioning within the currency world of the euro. They run a big budget deficit. The big North European banks, the German and French banks in particular, demand that they get repaid. And as a consequence, Greece was required to engage in a so-called bailout plan, whereby they had to impose extreme austerity on the Greek people so that they would have the funds available to repay the banks, the unpaid debt. Now, Greece does not have the capacity or the privilege just to produce or print dollars, because it's not the U.S. government, it's the Greek government. So does this theory that the government actually can print or not print as much of this currency, the dollar, does it apply to the United States, or is this theory a universal theory?
Neither. It is not exclusively applicable to the United States, nor does it apply to all countries, because as you rightly point out, Greece gave up what we call a sovereign currency. They gave up the drachma when they decided to become a member of the Economic and Monetary Union, the EMU project. So Greece stands now in a fundamentally different position vis-a-vis its currency than it did prior to adopting the euro. So when the Greek government was borrowing and taxing and spending in drachma, the debt to GDP ratio was well in excess of 100%. Okay, but there was no Greek debt crisis. The same was true of Italy, by the way. Back in the day when Italy was on the lira, the debt ratio in Italy was 120%, but there was no debt crisis in Italy. all of a sudden you give up the currency, you redenominate, all of your debt is now due in a currency that you no longer control. Now you're obligated to pay euros. And many of the countries in the EMU faced a debt crisis. So Italy, with the same debt ratio, 120% in 2010, suddenly has a debt crisis when it had no problem with a debt ratio of 120% in 1995, because all the debt was denominated in lira. Same for Greece. So it is the case that if you give up your own currency and you start borrowing and spending in a currency you don't control, the rules change. So these countries became more akin to individual states in the U.S. So sometimes I'll say, you know, Greece became more like the state of Georgia and Italy became more like Indiana. OK, but the rules of the game don't just apply to the U.S. In other words, the fiscal capacity, the ability of the government to spend in its own currency, that's true of any government that has what we call a floating non-convertible currency. So the U.S. can do it, Japan can do it, the U.K. can do it, Australia can do it, Mexico can do it, Canada can do it.
I hear exactly what you're saying. I think I understand what you're saying. Take an economy like Iran's economy, which operates, the currency is the rial. But in order to engage in international trade, Iran must be able to trade in, unless they have special bilateral arrangements, say with China or with Russia, where they're trading either in kind or based on mutual currency swaps. Almost all of the trade would be in dollars. And that's particularly true, say, in oil, which is the dominant part of the Iranian economy. They can't escape, in a way, the reality that the dollar printed by the U.S. government, which is hostile to their government, has that privilege of being the world currency. They can't simply create their own little island called Iran in terms of the currency and exempt themselves from the realities and vicissitudes of global trade. Anyway, talk about that if you would.
Well, you're right. You're right to point out that the limit in terms of what a government can afford to spend is given by, is determined by what is for sale in that currency. So if the rest of the world is not willing to produce things in order to get your currency, and people are not willing to offer their labor in exchange for your currency, then you can't purchase those goods and services. You can't hire those individuals. So the constraints are there. But what I'm suggesting, what MMT is about demonstrating that the limits are not on the money side. The limits are on the real side. So in the case of the U.S., the federal government of the United States of America can afford to buy whatever is for sale in U.S. dollars. They can afford to hire any unemployed individual who is willing to work to get the U.S. dollar, and we can afford to buy whatever the rest of the world wants to produce and sell to us for U.S. dollars. Does that mean that the federal government should go out and hire and buy everything that's for sale in dollars? No. But it does allow us to see through the fog that the limits on the government's ability to spend are not given by its ability to collect taxes or find dollars somewhere else in the economy. The limits are on the real side of the economy, the productive capacity and the willingness of people to supply their labor, to exchange real goods and services in order to get the government's money. Whether you're Japan or Canada or Australia, you can be a small open economy, you can be a large industrialized superpower. The trick is really whether people are willing to give up something in order to get your currency.
Let's ask Jim Kavanaugh the last question here, Jim. The Trump administration carried out this massive tax cuts at $1.4 trillion is the estimate. It's a very non-progressive tax cut. Most of the benefits go to the already fabulously wealthy. The Republican argument coming back afterwards is that, see, now we have this much less revenue to work with, and thus we have to cut socially needed, vitally needed programs that basically benefit a different class in society, poor people and working families. What modern monetary theory is suggesting, however, is that all of that is just a ruse for the redistribution of the wealth from the top or from the bottom to the top. In other words, Robin Hood in reverse. What do you say back, and what's the solution here? 1 minute left.
Well, it's true that we don't need that tax revenue for the program. So first of all, and that's one of the things we have to say in the fight, it's not about if you don't need the revenue. The question about the taxes is, where are you taking that money from in taxes? You're taking it from the poorest people. And the people who are overtaxed in this economy are working class people who are paying FICA and Medicare taxes that don't have to be paid, because they do not fund those programs. That's a fiction that's made to make it look like they're paying. And the people who have money that's being hoarded in the economy, being kept out of the economy, because they have so much money they don't know what to do with, that's where taxes should come from. I'm telling you, that's why there were 94% taxes in from Beardsley Rummel in 1946. They understood you take taxes from the wealthy for the purpose of not allowing there to be inequality. But we don't need the taxes either to pay for the social programs or to pay for the military. We don't. It's an accounting fact. But we don't. If we're locked in this cycle saying, oh, we should move this money from here to there and take taxes for this and not for that. And you're in that argument, you're getting into a trap, because you're feeding the idea that the government and the public programs are fed by private wealth.
We're going to leave it right there. That was the voice of Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. His latest piece on today's topic is Behind the Money Curtain, a left take on taxes, spending, and modern monetary theory. We were also joined from New York by Professor Stephanie Kelton. Stephanie Kelton is a prominent economist. She was an advisor, a senior advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign. She is a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She was the chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee 2015 Minority Party staff.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.